We do have a lot that we need to do in our pre-lab lecture today. We're going to take a break at some point, so you can get a break from me babbling on and on and on. But the two things we have to get through are the calculations for the first lab experiment, and then also an introduction to what you're doing for this next experiment. I'll tell you that by the time I get done talking about all of this, you're going to only have time to do one thing, and only one thing, which is to make the solid, to make the precipitate that's one of the early steps in your lab. So you're not going to be preparing any of the standardized solutions today. In fact, most of those solutions have already been prepared for you. There is one that we will have to prepare, which I'll talk about next time. We won't be doing any of the titration today, although I'm going to go briefly through what the titration is and why we're doing it. So the first part before we take the break will be to talk about the lab report, and then after the break we'll be talking about the new lab experiment. In terms of lab report format, let me explain first what normally occurs when you want to communicate scientific research, and then we'll talk about how we're doing a reduced version of that. So a large amount of scientific research ends up published in what are called peer-reviewed journals, P-E-E-R, peer, meaning someone that's your equal, someone that's in your field. And so what happens is you do some bit of research, you write it up in a formal paper, you present that to one of these publishing houses. Some of the really common ones in chemistry are Journal of the American Chemical Society, JAX for short. There's Journal of Organic Chemistry, if you're an organic chemist. There's Journal of Physical Chemistry. There's a number of international journals that are quite popular and quite established in research. So you might send it to one of these different publications depending on what their specialty tends to be in the type of research that they communicate. So you present it to them. They have an editor or a group of editors that then will send your research out to other people in the field for them to get feedback. And what they want to see is, does the research seem complete? Are there any other additional experiments they think that you need to do to make sure that you've done everything, covered all the possibilities? Do they agree with the method you use to acquire your data? Do they agree with the data that you collected? Does it make sense? Were your interpretations correct? And so all those different types of comments come back to the editors. They make an assessment and say, well, for example, yes, we will publish your research, but here's the other things that we think that you need to do first. Maybe we'll publish it, but you need your major rewrite. You got to go do all of this. No, we don't think it's worthy of publishing. Or every once in a while, you do everything perfectly the first time, and they say, yes, we'll publish that. And then that's what ends up being part of what's called the chemical literature, the collective set of all the available published research. And it's a good thing, in general, that research tends to go through this review process to make sure that, yes, the results do make sense, because other people are going to look at this research as the basis of their own research. So you want to prevent accidental errors, and you also are looking out for fraud, because, yes, there are times where you end up with people who falsify results, because unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to think of it, the only way you can do research is if you have money. And the only way that you get money is to go out and beg for it, usually. You, as a chemist, if you're working as a researcher, you're applying for grant money. So these communications, yes, you're reporting research, but you're also justifying why that money's coming your way. And occasionally you get people that aren't ethical and that do fake the research, which often comes back to haunt them. And there are sensational cases you hear of occasionally of high-powered people being disgraced by the fact that they've are uncovered and that the research was just fake. So we in here, of course, are not publishing any results. We're not discovering anything new. But we are going to be using a modified form of the format you would use for one of these formal communications. And here's a brief version of how one of those communications would look like. If you've ever had a speech class, you probably heard your instructor say something like this, that if you're going to tell someone something, you're going to convince them of something or describe something, you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them, meaning that you give some brief introduction to the topic so their mind already is getting set for that. Then you talk about the main point that you want to make, And then in case they fell asleep somewhere in there, then you wrap it up with a quick conclusion at the end to make your point about what all this other stuff was that you were talking about. So you tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them what you told them. So in a scientific communication, it might look something like this. You start out with a very brief synopsis of what it is that you intend to do and a description of the past research that justifies why you're doing what you're doing. So there you're both giving scientific basis to your experiment, and again, because of the money, then you're also justifying the expense that you had in doing that research. You'll then include a detailed procedure. You'll put all of your data, your calculations, your conclusions, and then you'll wrap that up by saying, well, here is what was done, you know, again, making the point of what those results show. And then you might say, well, here's the further research that this enables to show where you're going to go next. Of course, sometimes researchers are very careful about that because, yes, there are groups that compete for results. So you might not say exactly what you're going to do next just so that your neighbor doesn't steal your results and therefore your patent before you. How are we going to modify this for us in here? Well, you're still going to be doing those three things essentially. Aside from a title that you're going to give me, the first thing that you're going to have in your report is your purpose statement, where you're going to tell me what was the point of the experiment. At the end of the experiment, you're going to have a conclusion statement, and those two things are going to match each other. In between, you're going to have your data and calculations. So let me tell you a little bit more about each one of these sections. Yes, give me some kind of title, and for those of you who are going to email me your reports, make sure in your email message, the subject message of the message, that you say lab report of some sort. Preferably mention that it's 1C, because I do have a 12B class that I'm teaching as well. Just makes it a little easier to sort the emails. Do not include questions about your report in that email, because if it happens to be that it's a few days before I get to your lab reports, you don't want your question just sitting around waiting for me to see it. So that's why I'm saying don't send questions along with your lab report. But back to the format, give me a title and then your purpose statement. Your purpose statement is supposed to be an expression of the qualitative or quantitative results that you expect to get in the experiment. What it should not be is anything to do with your learning process. And the reason I point that out is the same type of thing we got taught when we were in grad school. That when someone comes along and says, why are you working on that project? The answer is not supposed to be, because my boss told me so. You're supposed to be able to explain what it is that you are doing research-wise. What are the results you're looking for? So yes, of course you all are chemistry students, but I disagree with the way that purpose statements are sometimes written in lab text. They might say the purpose of this lab is to learn how to do this technique. To me, in the way that we write reports, normally formal reports, it doesn't matter the person that's doing that research. It only matters what the results are. So I don't want you to refer to the learning process. I want you to refer only to the results. And what was the purpose then of this first experiment? To determine the freezing point depression constant for water. Because remember, we had a series of solutions where you had glycerol and water. We saw in lecture there's an equation that we can use to take the molality of the solution, something about the solute, the ionization constant, and then another constant that is appropriate for the solvent, not the solute. The solute only matters in the sense of how many particles it breaks up into solution. Otherwise, the identity of the solute does not show up in the equation. So we are determining the freezing point depression constant of water. If that's your purpose statement, you're also at the end going to have a conclusion statement, which better match and be in parallel with your purpose statement. So if the purpose is to determine the freezing point depression constant of water, well, then your conclusion should be the freezing point depression constant of water is whatever that value is that you calculated it. Now, of course, you're going to do the work to show that in between. But I want you to wrap it up in a nice little bundle like that to show me that you understand what the point of the lab was and that you're capable of reporting those results. This is not usually a problem later in the chemistry career that you all have, but particularly Chem 1A students, I'll see that in a titration, for example, they might say the purpose of a titration is to learn how to do titration. No, purpose is you wanted the molarity of something in solution. But even if they said that their purpose was to learn how to do titration, then the conclusion might be something like, well, the experiment went well. Well, what does well mean? So that's failing to identify correctly the purpose, failing to have your conclusion match your purpose statement. You have a very clear purpose statement, which I've told you. I know I'm not writing this down. That's just so there's some mystery as to how you're going to maybe word that. But I've told you what the purpose is, and then therefore what the conclusion statement's going to be for this experiment. Now, there are a few other things that need to go into your report. One thing that does not go into your report is procedure, because you've already supposedly written that out for your pre-lab. So I don't want you to go through the busy work of typing that procedure up again. I don't even want to go through the formal dance of you quoting that there is a lab text from which you got the procedure, which, yes, maybe we would do, but I just don't care. We'll take some simplifications in some places with the lab reports. So the two things in between your purpose statement and conclusion are going to be data and calculations, which, by the way, everything I'm talking about in terms of format is in your syllabus. So later on, if you don't remember the dozen things I tell you to do, well, the go back and everything is in your syllabus, including whatever formatting guidelines that I'm going to give you. In terms of data and calculations, you have a mixture of things that you did in this experiment. You have some masses that you wrote down, the masses of glycerol and water. You're going to be using those masses to determine molalities. So that's a form of calculation. You have graphical data that you're going to come up with, these eight different freezing point runs that you did. You're going to generate a graph for each one. So that's data. But you're going to analyze that to come up with a freezing point, which you then use to make another graph, which is going to be effectively a calculation. So the reason I'm mentioning all these pieces is that in beginner labs, in 1A labs, I like to make a much more formal distinction between data and calculations, which is a very, very minor annoying point, but chemists are good at that kind of thing. Data are things, meaning data as a word is a plural word. So bad English is the data is. You'll hear it, but if you hear reporters that are well trained, they'll get it right. They say the data are good, because datum is the singular word, the Latin word from which data comes from. So I know we're used to thinking data is singular, but wrong. Data are plural. So what is the difference between data and calculations? Let me talk about the example of measuring your masses. Some of you might have done the following. You took your test tube, and maybe the beaker that holds the test tube, you got the mass of that first, you put your glycerol in, you got the mass of the two of them together, you subtracted out that mass of the beaker or test tube from the combined mass, and by that difference you got the mass of glycerol. Is that how some of you did it? Okay, so out of those things I just mentioned, what's data and what's calculation? How about the mass of glycerol itself? Calculation, because you took two numbers and subtracted them. So as soon as you do anything with two different numbers, that's a calculation. If you directly observe the masses of the test tube and then the test tube with the stuff in it, those two things are pieces of data. And the reason I want to separate those two is related to how I want you to format calculations. So I'll explain that in a bit. But it makes much more sense sometimes to combine data and calculations for the sake of the logic of your report. So for example, you've got these masses of water and glycerol that you've measured, which you're going to use to calculate molalities. For each solution, you're also going to measure or come up with a specific freezing point. So it makes logical sense to put all those things in one table because they're related to each other, even though it technically is a mixture of data and calculations. So I'm just saying in the syllabus, it's a bit more strict. But you're 1C, not 1A students. And your experiments are conceptually a little bit more complex. So then the boundary between data and calculation might get a little bit more blurred. So normally, whenever you have data that are appropriate to be put in a table, you do need to use tables. So you do have to have some minimal formatting skills. There is one table that I'll describe in a moment that you'll want to include. But let's first address these eight graphs that you have to generate, because that is the largest set of data that you have in this experiment. The table that I'm about to show you, because I'm going to type one in to make a graph from it, these tables with all the different temperature measurements, it's okay that you do not include that in your report. If I really cared, I can collect your lab books and see that your data are there and see that they match. But I want just the graph I'm about to describe as part of your report. So you have your data with you? You got it? Okay. Let me turn on the spreadsheet program here, and then I'd like to get from you the temperatures that you had for experiment run 1, the lowest concentration solution. Now, did you measure your temperature at fixed intervals?
Yeah.
What was your interval? 15 seconds. So 15, 30, 45, so on and so forth. Okay. Now, this is not a class in how to use computers, and I know that not everybody in the world uses Excel. It just happens to be the big gorilla out in the market there. But whatever spreadsheet program you happen to use, it probably does similar things to what I'm describing. I'll admit that I'm going to be a little bit lost my own self at times because I'm a Mac user and have been since there were Macs. So I, even to this day, never have to use PCs much. And it's not that I hate them. I just don't have to use them. So I get a little lost at times. So if I can fumble around on a PC, though, to show you at least what you need to be doing for your experiment, you all can take the time to figure out how to do it on your own computer systems. So I am going to use Excel because it is what I tend to use. And I was just told that in this first experiment you had measurements that by this person that were done. Jesse? Huh?
Christian.
Okay, I'll get it right. I'll learn. Jesse back here then, right? Okay. Over here. Okay, there's two Jessies. All right. I'll get it. When I start turning papers back with grades on it, that's when I start to match the faces with the name. So first time we pass up the back, I'll get better at it. Christian, did you mark down as time 0 your first measurement or 15 seconds? 15. Okay. So you could type in manual 15, 30, 45, but if you have a set of numbers that follow a pattern like that, you can select that whole set, grab the corner of that selection box, and it will automatically fill in the rest of the numbers for you. It's just a little itty-bitty time-saving trick. Could you please read out for me the temperatures that you had for your set of data?
1.7.
Went up?
Negative
2.6. There we go.
This is for just a number 100.
Yes.
Yeah,
you only had 2 data points?
Yeah, I froze.
Oh, okay. So it's going to be hard to analyze your data correctly, and I'll show you why in just a moment. But that's okay. We're learning what to do in cases where things didn't quite go ideally. Did someone have a larger set of numbers that they collected and would like to share their data? For number 1, yes. What was your time interval?
30
seconds. So every 30 seconds? Did anybody else measure it on a smaller time frame, 15 seconds? 5? Every 5 seconds?
Just for trial
1. How many numbers do you have? Okay, that's fine. So 5, 10, 15, and so on. Could you please give me your temperature measurements?
We start at zero.
You did start at zero, okay?
Zero is 5.2. 4.7. 4.7. 3.3. 1.7.
Negative 1.4.
Negative
2.7.
Negative
2.6.
Negative 2.6. 2.4.
And is what, I'm sorry?
It's 2.4 to 2.5 in
70
seconds.
Okay. That's a good enough set of data. In Excel, like other programs, if you have one column that's on the left and one column on the right, it will presume that the one on the left is the x-axis and the one on the right is the y-axis, which is exactly the way that we want to set up these graphs because we wanted to monitor the temperature change over time. Since we're not going to do anything with this graph except potentially print it out, I'm going to say to insert a scatter graph in which the curve is connected. And then this is the type of graph that's generated. So notice what we've got, a steady decrease in temperature that seems to have a little itty-bitty dip to it that then comes up and plateaus nicely. This is nearly the ideal behavior for a freezing solution. You're supposed to have a linear change in temperature until it freezes, then it should platform, and then it should drop in temperature again, which they had said that it was starting to drop towards the end of their set of measurements. Yes? So the question is, if you have a mismatch of your intervals, then just put in whatever data points you happen to have. The only reason I asked at first if there was a fixed interval is so I could show that trick of filling in the set of data by doing the spreadsheet drag. So if you have different times, then just manually input those numbers in. And how you format it doesn't matter because all I want to see is the graph, not the data in this case. What are we going to do to analyze the graph? Well, if you have an easier case like theirs, where there is an obvious flat line, then that is going to be presumed to be the freezing point temperature. Remember that where it dips below here, that's where you're possibly having the effect of supersaturation. So it's when it comes back up and plateaus that that's the temperature that we trust. If you don't have a nice flat line like that, then what you might have to do is print the graph out and then draw a line manually along that part of the curve to try to figure out where it hits back over here at the y-axis. If you're going to do something like that, and this might sound strange, but I'll explain the reasoning, you might want to throw away some of the data. You might say, well, how can we throw data away? Well, we could throw it away if it has no bearing on our analysis. All of the solutions start up closer to room temperature, so all of the solutions are going to have this downward trend. It's right here where we get closer to this flat line that we care much more about the temperature change. So if I wanted to end up with a more expanded graph, what I could do is keep that same set of data, but only focus on where we're much closer to the temperature range we care about. So let's see what that kind of graph would look like. So about the same shape in a sense, but notice that my axis has got more divisions to it. If you select the options for this graph, you can go back in and put a finer division line if you have to go back in and draw a line. Now, you don't have to draw the lines electronically. You do have to create the graph electronically. And I don't know if you've read the syllabus, and I don't think I mentioned this yet. Your lab reports themselves may not be handwritten. They have to be in some way typeset, which for most of you means going to do it on the computer. If some of you are rocking the old school typewriter still, then that's fine too. But no handwritten. Yeah, some of you are like, what's a typewriter? What's vinyl? Isn't that something you wear? That's all we had when I was a kid to listen to music. But that's because I'm older than dirt, I guess. Anyways, back on track here. Your graphs and lab reports have to be computer-generated or somehow non-handwritten. If you have to write a line, though, on your graph, that you can do with a ruler and a pen on the graph that you've printed out. Most of you may not have to do that because you might have nice plateau regions like that. I don't know because it's been a while since I've done this experiment and I don't recall what people tend to get as data. But what do you have to do? You have to generate these eight graphs. You can take these graphs and throw them right into your word processing program. So let me show you as an example of that. So I could take this graph, select it, copy it, move over to my word processing program, paste it in, where then I could, if I wanted to, put another graph. I'll be quick by putting the same one on here. But in other words, you can stuff more than one graph on your paper. For those of you who know a little bit more about formatting, you can change the size of the graph on your paper, and you can also change the flow of text, the layout. So right now, the default is that this is the only thing that's going to be on this line, and then I can start a new line. But you could make it where your report text takes up all the empty space here. That's the type of formatting I used on the syllabus. So it's whether you have it as an outline box or whether, I mean, it's called different things in different programs, but you can change the type of layout that you have. You don't have to spend hours and hours making this as fancy as possible. You do have to have all eight graphs in your lab report. So it could be something like this, but if you are going to be putting all of these different graphs in, then somehow or another, for each graph, make sure you put in some kind of description of what it is and refer to which solution number it is. What you have to get from these graphs are these freezing points, these flat parts of the curve. So you're going to have eight different values that you get that are going to be put into a table. All right, does that much make sense so far, this part of the data analysis? Then let's talk about what else you have to do to finish up your report. So there is an equation that you're going to be using, the calculation of molality. Let me describe how I want you to format equations. Again, this is in the syllabus. For each equation that you use in a lab report, the first time you use that equation, I want you to write it out in equation form. And what I mean by that is you don't put numbers in, you use variables or even words if you would choose to. So this first calculation that you've got is for calculating the molality of solution. So molality is equal to, one moment here, it is the mass of glycerol that you used divided by the molar mass of glycerol. That whole thing divided by the mass of water. Main thing to remember there is that we need kilograms as our unit, so remember to turn your units of into kilograms for the mass of water. Back to talking about the how to format the calculations. I want you to write this equation out once in word or variable form. So you could come up with other variables, logical abbreviations if you want to. You could leave it in word form like this. Do you have to be able to draw a fraction like that? No, but if you feel like spending the time, most programs do have equation editors where you can make quite sophisticated equations. The only reason that I think it's worthwhile for you to spend some time on these kinds of things is for when you eventually have to get in that thing called the real world and get a job. For example, when you read over resumes, which I've had to do my own self, you can look at one and see that it's very nicely formatted. It may not hide the fact that they did or did not do a lot, but it looks appealing to at least read. Then you come across the resume that just looks like a bunch of stuff thrown on a page doesn't look like the person has skills or can be bothered, so then that goes in the pile that you read later if you ever get around to it. So it's good to have some of these formatting skills to make yourself look presentable when you're out on the job market. So I want you to write the equation out once, then I want you to take one set of your data, put the numbers in there, and then show me what the result is. So this form of the equation I call the prototype, because you're just giving me what the equation looks like. Then you have a substituted equation where you're using your real data. Why do I have you do these two things? Because there's two mistakes you could potentially make if I didn't spend as much time going over the calculations like I normally will do. If you're kind of left up to your own to figure out the calculations, then I want to see, do you know which equations that you're supposed to use to analyze your results? But even though most people get that right, where a simpler mistake, but one that happens frequently, is that you accidentally take the wrong type of data and put it into the wrong equation. You know, you might take one mass number and put it in for another because they were both masses, but maybe you got the wrong mass. So by doing a prototype equation, I can see you know which equation to use or that you have it in the right form. And by doing a substituted equation, I know that you know which data to pull from. Now, beyond that, it makes no sense to show me the same calculation over and over and over again. So, for example, in this experiment, you have 8 molalities you have to calculate. You're only going to write this equation twice. Once this way with the words, once taking one set of data and substituting it. Do not show me multiple calculations. In fact, I will take points off for it. Why? Because it's a waste of space, a waste of time, and it drags the reader down trying to read your report. Once I see that you know how to do a calculation correctly once, you're not going to get any more affirmation by showing it to me 8 separate times. Don't waste the time and electronic or physical paper putting all those useless calculations in. So, one prototype equation, like the one there, one substituted equation. You're going to come up with your 8 molalities, and then you're going to have the 8 freezing points from the 8 graphs that you generate. And so here's the table that I would recommend that you make. So have one column where you list that you have the 8 different solutions. You might have next your glycerol mass. If you put grams up in your heading like this, then you don't have to list grams after every number that you write. It can, for some of you, make it more visually appealing. Similarly, you're going to need the mass of water. You're going to be calculating that molality. And then you'll have the freezing point in degrees Celsius. By the way, learn how to make the degree sign. Don't just take a 0 and try to make it a superscript or something like that. You're all laughing because you've all done it. I know. Learn it on your own computer. Speaking of zeros and such, water is H2O with an oxygen with a letter O, not H2O as in the number 0. And yeah, I've been doing this too long so that when I read a lab report in most fonts, I can see the difference between a 0 and an O. It's just that little bit of looking scientifically educated, that one of those little pet peeve type things that jumps out at me. Related to that, if you've got to write chemical formulas, write it down with appropriate subscripts and superscripts. If you just have one line with all the letters the same size, again, it looks like you can't be bothered to learn. Another thing that I have to mention, I take the viewpoint that the lab report is a way of communicating results and that does not have anything to do with the personal identity of the researcher. The idea that in science we make a distinction between the objective and the subjective, and so that we try to focus on the results and not on the researchers that come up with those results. The humanitarian side would say that's garbage. It is because of us that are able to achieve and reach that point of doing research that that research becomes possible. But most scientific journals don't focus on that. They focus on the research. The point is, in your reports, do not use any form of first or second person. First person meaning I, or words related to that. I, my, me, we, our, us. No second person, no you, y'all. I did that this morning. They don't like it when I start using my old original voice, but I don't break that out that often because people just think it doesn't sound right around here. But no matter how many years I've lived here, I still can't help but every once in a while a y'all slipping out, especially if I'm getting upset at someone. So no second person, no cheating second person either, as such as this statement. One should be careful in the lab. Well, one is just another way of saying you, which is second person, which means you don't use it. So if you have to say something like, I spilled the material, the material was spilled. Again, to remove that human from the lab report to focus on the results. I thought of all that just because I saw that little degree sign and I thought about formatting in lab reports. There is one more thing that I might have mentioned already, which is that your spell checkers aren't brain checkers. And so that if you write T-R-A-I-L, which is an acceptable English word, which is a running path, a trail, your spell checker may not know that you're writing a lab report where you have trials, T-R-I-A-L. And so if you label your report with trail 1 and trail 2 and trail 3, I'm going to feel even worse that I'm not running enough. So make sure you have trial 1, trial 2, and trial 3. Okay? Back to this table. This is the one table that you need to make. How you format it exactly, I'm going to leave it up to you. Some of you that do know formatting tricks and want to spend a couple of minutes on, you can pretty it up. But otherwise, you at least need to have it in table form. It is not acceptable to have a list of numbers because that's just bad presentation. Any questions about the table that you got to make? Okay. This is not the end result, though. Where we need to get to is the freezing point constant for water. And so next we're going to use this equation, except this equation is not going to show up in your calculations. Because we're going to graphically extrapolate to get the value of K in this case. Now this is the same equation that we saw for boiling point elevation, except for two things. It's now freezing point, so I have F instead of B. And a little negative sign that I forgot to throw in at first this morning, which annoyed everybody. Temperature changes for freezing point are always negative changes because it's freezing point depression. So the equation has a negative in it like that. What is I going to be in our specific lab? One. Who said one? Why one? Because glycerol doesn't what? It does not dissociate. Or technically it does, but in such a tiny, 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 tiny amount, it's effectively zero. So since it does not effectively dissociate, that means each mole of glycerol that goes into solution only makes one mole of particles. It's the total number of particles that matter. That's why that I factor is there. And yes, I is going to be one for this experiment. Since the solute for this experiment is glycerol, which does not dissociate to any appreciable extent in solution, the ionization factor is equal to 1. So let me rewrite the equation. The change in freezing point temperature is going to depend then on just this constant and the molality. Let me rewrite this expression one more time, solving for the freezing point depression constant. That it is that change in freezing point temperature divided by molality. Now suppose we take that equation, the right-hand side, and make the numerator the y-axis, and we then made the denominator the x-axis. Well, then the change in temperature divided by molality is the slope, which means that if we were to take our data points, the eight of them, and graph them and make the best fit line we could to connect all those data points, that the slope for that line is equal to the freezing point depression constant. So that's a graphical extrapolation, which is the last thing that you have to do for your lab report. So let me show you how to do that. I'm going to make up a totally set fake set of data. Let's say that I had a set of eight solutions that all were larger than the next by 0.5 molal. So in other words, let's say I have a 0.5 molal solution, 1 molal, 1.5, up to 3.5. So there's eight different solutions. Let's say that I had some freezing points that I'll just make up here. So let's say they were negative 1.4, negative 3.21, negative 4.6, negative 5.98, negative 7.7, negative 8.8, and then negative 10.4. This portion, this little bitty table that I just made, you don't have to include in your report because you've got the bigger table that already has these values. So you might want to just take these values separately and make a graph out of it. This time when you make the graph, though, I'm going to make a scatter graph where it's just XY coordinates because I don't want to just draw lines between each point. I want to force the program to extrapolate the data to find the best fit line. On this version of Excel, the way you do that is you select your data and and you add a trend line. A trend line is the word in this program meaning a linear or a graphical extrapolation. We are going to do a linear type of extrapolation, or it's also called a regression. Because the relationship between the temperature and molality is a linear relationship. We do want to restrict the way that we do this interpretation, though, because we want to make sure that the line passes through the origin. Because if you have no solute, then there's nothing affecting the temperature of the solution, the freezing point of the solution. And on this program, it does have a way to do that, where you set the intercept to zero. Then I also want to have it display the equation on the graph I generate, because then that way I can look and I can see that the slope here was negative 2.99. Well, there's a negative in the equation, so that means that the freezing point constant for this solvent is 2.99, which is exactly the type of number that you're looking for. So, you will need to create this graph and include this as well. Again, I would strongly recommend that you print the equation out on the graph. There are some formatting tricks you can do, one of which, at the least I would do, is if you select the legend, if your program automatically creates a legend, the legend is kind of useless in this case. What a legend is for is to tell you what type of data that you have in the graph. But you only have one set of data, so there's no question what it is. So why do you need a legend there to take up space when you can have a larger, more visible graph if you clear up that room? Beyond that, again, I'll leave it up to you to make some judicious choices about how you label the graph. For example, it might be good to put axi labels in there to show me that you have molality versus temperature. In the report itself, you, of course, are going to need to have a title for your graph. And don't assume I know what it is. Go through the formalities of formatting your report properly. So let me summarize what I've talked about so far. You've got the title for your experiment. You've got the purpose statement, which is related to the results and not about you. And the suggestion I made is that the purpose statement for this lab should be that it is to determine the freezing point depression constant for water. You have your data, which the best way to arrange it in this case is to put the 8 graphs in first. Then you can put it in your calculation section if you want to. You'll have the table. Well, first you'll have the example of calculating your molalities, and then you'll have the table that has your masses, molalities, and the freezing point numbers that you got from your graphs. You'll then have this one more graph where you're doing the linear extrapolation of those freezing point temperatures. The slope of that graph, the negative of it, is going to be the freezing point constant. So after your calculations, your next section is the conclusion where you put in the freezing point depression constant of water is whatever it happens to be. There is one more section that goes in your lab report. Sometimes it might be a section that we skip entirely. Sometimes it might be something we put information in, and that's your discussion section. So what the discussion section is not is what you might have done for some of your other instructors. I don't want you to include a big theoretical discussion about your report. The reason being is you get that on the lab quiz. So I'm trying to put the focus on the calculations for each experiment, but then for the lab quizzes, we worry about the theory. So that might shorten your report for some of you because you might have had to write up a lot about theory in the past. Here's another thing I don't want you to put in. Every single possible error you can think of. That might be good for you to think about in general, but then I start getting useless comments or things that, especially in 1C level, there's some things we don't worry about anymore. Like, for example, you could say, yes, the balances might have been miscalibrated, but we calibrate them every quarter to make sure that you all get decent results. So yes, it is reasonable to say that that you should worry about your machinery and your equipment, but I'm telling you, don't worry about all the general cases. If you spilt some of your glycerol out after you measured it, and then you put water in to make your solution, then you don't know what your molality of that solution really is, and that's a real problem. And so you could put something like that in your lab report. Don't put something like this in. Well, the boiling point of that solution might have been a little bit off from normal because the pressure of the room was changing an awful lot because that high pressure system coming down from Canada was really causing some severe weather in the area. And of course, there was a full moon, which means there was a greater gravitational attraction by the moon. And so the seas were rising and dogs and cats living together and mass hysteria. You know, don't need to put things like that. Old movie quote, if you all didn't get the end of that. So, that's not the type of thing I want. What should you put in there? Any comparison you might be able to make to known values, literature values. So the freezing point depression constant for water is well known. You are making a calculation of it, so I want you to do a percent error. So that will be the last thing that you put in your report. Yes, if I was being a stickler, it might be something you put in your calculation sections, but because I'm telling you that you're going to mention percent error in your discussion section, it's also okay to put that calculation in your discussion section. Just do something logical. As far as the formula for percent error, there's a version that some of you might have learned that use absolute signs. I don't like that version. So what would the version look like without an absolute sign? Now, we've all had percent error before. Wow. Really? No takers? Not even guesses? Yes. Very close. Experimental minus theoretical over theoretical times 100%. Why do we divide by the theoretical value? To get us the sense of scale, to get it in terms of percentage. Why do we subtract the theoretical value from the experimental value? Because then built into the number is an indication of whether your value was too high or too low, meaning you had a positive error or negative error. So if you were supposed to measure 4, but you got 5 instead, well, you're going to be on a positive error, because larger number minus a smaller number. Conversely, if you're supposed to get 4, you got 3 instead. Then you're going to have a negative error automatically based on the way that this expression is structured. And so you don't have to take the number and then comment on it being high or low, because that error is already shown to be high or low by whether it's positive or negative. So it might seem like it's a small thing, but I always, for some reason, am uncomfortable with using absolute signs with error, because it's useful to know if your error is big or small. That's the last thing in your report in your discussion section, and so that's it for the format of your lab reports. Does anyone have any question about the formatting of lab reports? Yes. Just graphs, tables, calculations, and then the final value, the dry stuff, yes. Yes. The percent error, yes, I would like in the discussion section.
So that's the only thing that's going to be discussion.
Most likely, for most of you. Unless you had something specific that you know went wrong and you wanted to comment on it in your experiment. Yes? Say it one more time. In this program that is called Scatter with Smooth Lines. What I would like to do now is to talk about your next experiment, which is called the Common Ion Effect. We are not going to get through many of the details of this experiment today. There's a lot of new concepts that we need to cover that we're just starting to get to in lecture. This is going to be about the solubility of a compound, calcium iodate. Solubility we're going to discuss in terms of equilibrium, and we're going to be talking more specifically about the solubility product, the KSP, which is an equilibrium constant related to the solubility of this calcium iodate. What we're also going to be looking at is the effect of having a common ion in solution. We're going to be taking the calcium iodate and dissolving it into two different environments. One where we just have plain water, and one environment that already has some calcium around. What we're going to see is that by already having calcium present, that's going to affect how much calcium iodate is going to be able to dissolve, because calcium is both in the solution that you're going to put the solute in and it's in the solute itself. That's why it's called a common ion effect. We also have a redox reaction that we're using, because we are going to be trying to calculate the amount of iodate that comes out into solution. And we're going to be assessing the amount of iodate using a redox titration, just like the one that you did back in Chem 1A. So we need to talk about those different theoretical aspects. We need to talk about how you're physically doing the experiment. But as I said, we're not going to get through much of it today. So at least let me give you an overview. As I mentioned, the key solid that you're going to be making is calcium iodate. This does dissociate to some extent in solution, making calcium plus two ions and iodate ions. This is an equilibrium process, which means that how much goes into solution depends on there being a balance between how much solid that might be present is dissociating, how many of these ions are trying to react together to make the solid again. Why would the amount of ions change from solid to solid? It depends on the energetic nature of that solution formation, meaning if it is energetically favorable in terms of delta G for the solid to dissociate, then you'll have a large equilibrium constant. If you have a small equilibrium constant, that means it's not going to want to dissociate much in solution because it's not energetically favorable for it to do so. The equilibrium constant for this case does not follow the most general format. The most general format is that you have products raised to their stoichiometric coefficients divided by reactants raised to their stoichiometric coefficients. But we have a solid for reagent, and a solid does not have a calculatable concentration because it's not part of the solution. And so we leave something like that out of the expression. So this kind of equilibrium expression will only have the product ions in it, and it's got a special name to it, which is KSP. And so it's the products raised to the stoichiometric coefficient. So since we make two iodates by the dissociation of one calcium iodate, that's why iodate ends up being squared in this expression. You're going to prepare this solution by reacting calcium nitrate with potassium iodate. This is the full expression. If we were in 1A, we could spend some time about talking about the full ionic equation and net ionic equation, but that's not 1A. But just pointing out, this is a precipitation reaction, so there is one product and only one product that we write in solid form. There will still be potassium and nitrate that are spectator ions, but we're going to be filtering this solution after we make it to isolate the solid to use in the next part of the experiment. This is as much as we're going to get done today. Even though we'll have some time left to work, it's going to take longer than you think it does to measure everything out, get the precipitate to form, leave it for the 5-10 minutes it says for you to let it react, filtering it, and then getting that into your locker. Since I'm talking about the formation of that solid, let me point out that you are going to be collecting that solid by vacuum filtration. Have any of you not ever done a vacuum filtration? Just to remind ourselves how that works, though, you're going to use a vacuum flask, which is pretty much like a regular Erlenmeyer flask, except it's going to have what's called a sidearm, which does not mean you're packing heat. It just means that you have a way to connect to something on the side. That's going to be hooked up to a vacuum. And then you're going to have a Hirsch funnel, which is a white porcelain funnel that will have a rubber adapter to it. This morning, we ran out of adapters. So what you should do is each person check out a Hirsch funnel so you can each have your own platform to collect this solid. But you might have to share the adapters, so share the vacuum part of that setup. The Hirsch funnel has a grating in it that has little tiny holes in it. And so you'll need to cover that with a piece of filter paper. The filter paper is located over in the toolbox that's close to the exit here. That same toolbox also has other random minor lab supplies, like I think there might be test tubes in there or capillary tubes for doing melting point measurement. And then there's also some cotton balls and labels and other things you might need. So the filter paper is over there, and the filter paper you need is a little bit larger than a quarter in size. That will fit down on the surface of that Hirsch funnel. You might want to wet it with some deionized water. I say deionized because we don't want other ions affecting our results. Then you can just pour the entire solution that is formed by those two things reacting, the calcium nitrate and the potassium iodate. It'll take a few minutes, but they'll form a precipitate. That whole thing with all of the solid you're going to pour into the Hirsch funnel, you're going to have some of it pass through, which that portion you don't care about, that gets disposed of. It's the solid that you want to collect. Now, after you do that initial pour of the resulting precipitate into the Hirsch funnel, you might want to wash out that beaker or Erlenmeyer with a little bit of water. It says cold water in the procedure, but there's a low enough solubility of the calcium iodate that as long as you just use a small quantity of room temp water, you should be okay. So you transfer all of that solid through, filter it through. You do want the mass of the solid because it says to calculate the percent yield. However, it makes no sense to measure that mass today because you need to let all of the water evaporate. So at the end of the filtration, take that piece of filter paper, put it onto a watch glass. You'll leave that in your locker just to have the water evaporate over the long weekend. It'll be a week, by the way, because we do not have lab Monday. We have lab on Wednesday, which does remind me, I forgot to mention for the lab reports. The lab reports are due at 2:30 when this lab begins. So for those of you who are going to email me, you need to email me before you come to class, before 2:30. Those of you who are going to come here and physically turn in your lab reports, don't tell me that your printer had problems the night before, the 20 seconds before class, because you know a week ahead of time that that lab report's going to be due. And I did tell you a time, so no, you can't come in and say, may I please email my lab report later, please, 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 because that meant that you just couldn't get the time to finish it, which you've got a week to do it. So remember, 2:30 is your due time for your lab report. Back to talking about the experiment. So the solid, I'm describing the formation of that solid. You're going to prepare it today, store it in your lockers over the weekend. You do not need secondary containment. As a reminder, secondary containment is what we've got with all the solutions that are over here, because we are supposed to keep anything that's liquid in a second container. So if that original bottle breaks somehow, it doesn't go flowing all over the lab and potentially causing a hazardous reaction. We have a solid we're making as a product, though, so we don't have to take that same precaution, especially since it's not a volatile solid. So we can keep it open in our benches to dry out over the weekend. On Wednesday when we come back, then you can get the mass to calculate the percent yield that you're supposed to calculate for it. That's the formation of the solid, but that's not really the meat of this experiment. This is just the preparation. What are you going to do with the solid? You're going to divide it up into two flasks, roughly half and half in quantity of the solid. In one flask, you're going to have pure water. In the other flask, you're going to have calcium nitrate. The procedure says that it might be calcium nitrate or calcium chloride. We only have nitrates that are available. And there's a selection of concentrations, which you may choose which one you want to use. We have 0.1, 0.2, 0.4, and 0.6 molar. Doesn't matter which one, as long you write down which one you choose. The calcium iodate, you're going to try to dissolve as much as possible. Not very much of it is going to dissolve. That's why we're using an excess of solid, though, to ensure that we saturate the solution. You're then going to filter the solids back out again, collecting only the liquid from each one. So one of these, after the filtering, is flask A, and one of them is flask B. Both of these flasks you're going to titrate in order to calculate the iodate concentration. Not the calcium concentration, the iodate concentration. Why is it useful to know the iodate concentration? Well, we could talk about the water solution at first, because in water, the concentration of calcium ions is going to be exactly half that of iodate, because the formula is 2 iodates per calcium. Why is this important? Because I could take the KSP expression that I had up above, and substitute for calcium, so that I get the KSP is 1/2 of the iodate concentration cubed. But that means I only have to test for iodate concentration to come up with the KSP value, which is good for us to know so that we know that our technique gives us reasonable values, because KSP of calcium iodate is well known. What are we doing with solution B then? What are we testing for? Well, we're also going to test for its concentration, the iodate ion. And what we hope to see is that ion concentration is going to be lower because of this thing called the common ion effect. Let me pull down this page just for a moment to show you the chemical reaction up at the top. Iodate, calcium iodate dissociating into the two types of ions. Think of this as an equilibrium, and now imagine that we add calcium in on the right-hand side. We're adding a product. Well, the Chatelier's principle would tell us that when we add products to the mixture, that means that the reverse reaction becomes much more likely, and so some of that product is going to want to react backwards in order to become precipitate, which is going to remove calcium from the solution, but it's also going to remove iodate from the solution, because those two are combined or needed to make the solid. Now, let's say that we weren't adding calcium. Let's say the calcium was there to begin with, and we add the calcium iodate in. Well, still, that means we're going to reach a higher calcium value than we would in plain water, which again means that the iodate concentration is not going to be able to build up as much, because this quotient here, this product, I mean, is going to reach its KSP much earlier. And as we'll discuss, once you have a value that's greater than KSP, that value being Q, the reaction quotient, when you have Q greater than KSP, that's when precipitation occurs. So since it's so much easier to get up to this KSP value when you already have calcium around, that limits how much of the solid's going to dissolve, and that is the common ion effect. That is the point of the experiment. Now let me talk about the titration just briefly, because this is the part that confused you, and I did not mark it off in your pre-labs, because I know some of you were having difficulty finding what to write up. And I did tell you in lecture that we already have the starch solution, so you don't have to worry about preparing it. But it is useful to go back to experiment 9, which is the experiment that it's really referring to, because that was the redox titration that you did, where you did this following set of reactions already. The iodate, yes, we do want to titrate it, but it turns out to be problematic if we want to do a visual titration, because this is a clear solution that you can react with a reducing agent, which might be a clear solution, to produce something that is also a clear solution And there aren't easy redox indicators like there are for acid-base reactions. Acid-base titrations, you can throw some other thing in there, the indicator, that will change color just based on the pH of solution. Redox reagents, not quite so simple, because there's not H plus or something identifiable that's moving around in solution. It's electrons. So, since it's difficult to directly titrate the iodate, what we're going to do is turn it into something else that is colored and can be titrated, and namely, we're going to produce iodine. So this part of the reaction is just like you did in Chem 1A, where you have iodate in solution that you're going to react with potassium iodide. Plus an acid source, which is a sulfuric acid. What you'll produce is iodine plus potassium sulfate plus water. I put a K in parentheses above iodate because in order to make this equation balance, we need 6 potassiums total, but I only had 5 explicitly written in the reagent side. So just pretend there's one more potassium around to make the iodate neutral, and now this equation balances. What again is the point of this equation? We're making iodine, which is very visible because it makes this definite yellowish, brownish, reddish solution. The iodine we're now able to titrate. The reagent that we use for that is sodium thiosulfate. Sulfate is SO4-2. Thio is a prefix indicating sulfur. So thiosulfate means take one of the oxygens away from sulfur and put take one of the oxygens away from sulfate and put sulfur in instead. So that's how we get S2O3. Reducing agent that will end up producing potassium iodide again, along with sodium iodide in this case, iodide we make again, along with the tetrathionate ion. It's a byproduct that I don't really care that you know that name, but it is something else that's formed in solution. So stoichiometrically, if we start with one iodate, by doing the first reaction, we produce 3 iodines as a result. The potassium iodide, Ki, is going to be thrown in excess along with the sulfuric acid. So that will guarantee that iodate is the limiting reagent in that reaction, guaranteeing that we'll have this 1-3 stoichiometry between iodate and iodine. The iodine will then require 2 thiosulfates to be titrated. And you titrate to the point where the color disappears. At the end of that, the end point, we hope that we're at the equivalence point, where stoichiometrically the right number of moles of one solution have reacted with the right number of moles of the other solution. In this case, it's going to be that one iodate requires 6 thiosulfates to react. Because one iodate makes 3 iodines, each iodine needs 2 thiosulfates, so we need 6 thiosulfates for each iodate. We'll know the concentration of the thiosulfate solution because we're going to standardize it. We'll know the volume of that solution we use, and we'll know the volume of our test solution, the iodate solution. That's 3 of 4 variables that we'll need, and so we'll be able to solve for the concentration of iodate. Now, what about the starch? Since I've mentioned this much of it, let me just explain that the starch is a visualization agent. Iodine, as the solutions get more and more and more dilute, that becomes a paler and paler color of yellow, which gets harder and harder to see. But you throw the starch in, and it will form a purple solution, which is much easier to monitor the color of. So, for today, You're not preparing any of the solutions. You're not doing any standardization. You're not doing any titration. All you're going to do is make that solid. The solution that you filter out, you don't care about, you'll dispose of, and there's already a waste bottle in the back of the classroom, the larger waste bottle that has my name on it. That's the one appropriate for this experiment. Again, don't measure the mass of the solid afterwards because you need to wait for the water to evaporate. I would recommend maybe to measure the mass of the filter paper before you do the filtration because sometimes, depending on how much that compound sticks to the paper, it can be hard to get all the compound off, or you might get to the point where you're worrying about whether you're scraping paper off or not. And so to get a more accurate mass measurement, why do any scraping? Just measure the mass of that filter paper ahead of time. I did get asked this morning, well, should we measure the mass of the watch glass and the filter paper? And they were probably thinking of the case in case the stuff spilled off the paper. And then, yeah, that might be a good idea to have that combined mass of the filter paper and watch glass to begin with. Now, as far as the filtration, the only vacuum system we do have are in the different fume hoods that are on the side of the room here. Make sure that you do use the yellow handle here. The yellow's for vacuum. The blue is for gas. That might produce some interesting results. So make sure you're using the right outlet. Please make sure you close those outlets again after you're done. It seems that we have a lot of time left, but the morning section, they barely got done for some reason. I think it might be the line that forms getting the chemicals, the line waiting for the balance room, and then just also waiting for that precipitate to form. I'm not entirely sure why. Must be some kinetic reason. But the precipitates don't form instantly. You do need to stir them for a few minutes. You will see more and more solid form. So if right after you mix the solutions together, nothing happens, that appeared to be normal behavior this morning. That's why you really do want to wait the 5 or 10 minutes it says to before you try to isolate that solid to make sure you get as much of the precipitate to form as possible.